Hello and welcome. You're listening to Adventures in the Vale, an RPG discussion podcast. I'm Jake.
I'm Ross.
Sit back and relax by the fire, for there are tales to be told.
Cozy Crow, come and sit by our fire. May I get you something to drink?
Yeah. I'll take an ale.
I'll have that right out.
Welcome back to the Cozy Crow Tavern and the Adventures in the Vale Tavern Cast. Here at the Tavern Cast, we talk about folk RPGs. My name is Ross McClure, a.k.a. Mythic Mountains, and I'm joined with my friend Jake. Hey, Jake.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me again. I like it here. Did you kill that troll yet?
So what were we talking about today?
Okay, so I guess I think that's a no. I think we're talking about characters, RPG characters.
And dwarves.
And dwarves too, which are sometimes the same
bonus.
Thing. Yeah. Sometimes they're the same thing, sometimes they're different. My first question for you is What was your first character you ever made for an RPG?
I hope that this doesn't make the podcast explicit, but the very first RPG I ever got to play in was a GURPS module.
That does sound explicit.
Gene Wolfe's Book of the New Sun, and in that, the protagonist is part of an organization called the Torturers Guild, and you're professional torturers. So that might offend some sensibilities for how RPGs work today. This was not that long ago, actually, because I didn't get to play in an RPG until toward the end of my time in the Army, and that was like in 2015. So it wasn't actually that long ago, but the game master liked Gene Wolfe and liked that module. I don't know. And anyways, my friend Rob and I were torturers from the Torturers Guild. Now, we didn't actually end up torturing anyone, for what that's worth. We ended up just, like, going on this adventure on the run from the guild because they blamed us for something we didn't do. And there was this witch that kept, like, kind of framing us for things that were happening. And we eventually were just trying to get to the source of it and figure out what was happening. So, actually, And that went on. That was like my first. I get to play in a campaign. We played for about 4 months, and I think my character was just like named Rob or Rock or something. Like it was like a corruption of just my name, because I didn't know, you know. And he was dumb and really neurotic.
But so it's like a human then.
He was a human, yeah. What was your first character?
So it depends. For an RPG specifically, I would say my first character I made was a dwarf rogue for D&D 5th edition.
Phaegrin, right?
Phaegrin was his name, yeah. Phaegrin, yeah. Gutbuster.
I remember. I don't remember that.
Yeah. Gutbuster. And he was a... strength-based rogue. We made it somewhat into a dungeon before we had a TPK of by these skeletons that they woke up. Like, everybody, we're in this, like, crypt, right? And everybody there knows, don't touch that altar with that whistle on it, because that's going to be bad. And then one guy's like, I'm going to go blow the whistle. And then all the skeletons wake up, and everybody dies, except for Phaegrin. But since I was the only one with a character left, everyone else is like, well, I don't want to make a new character, so I guess we're just done with this game. So then that game just kind of stalled out and never saw anymore, and that's how he died. Died as dust on the shelf.
Do you ever wonder about Phaegrin? Do you ever wonder what he's doing out there in the fictional multiverse? Is Phaegrin's living his best life? He's doing well out there? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I don't really think too much about him because I kind of wrote him off as dead whenever he has to make it out of the place alive by himself, you know?
Yeah.
And I have this thing where it's like, unless we're actually at a table with different people, I usually don't change things, you know. As a GM, you know, it's a sacred thing to have the table state and the game state the way it is until the players return, right? So I kind of feel that way a lot, unless I'm playing a solo game where, you know, I have the agency to do so.
Yeah.
Did the character have an interesting story or not? Clearly for mine, I think he didn't. I feel like that story just kind of abruptly ended. But what about you and your character? Did that have a good ending?
It had an awesome ending. So me and my friend Rob were both these torturers on this journey to try to figure out why we were being framed by this demigod-like witch. And she had the power to just appear places and stuff. And we eventually made it to the halls of the Emperor, who was, I suppose, the hegemon of the entire human race at the time or something. And somehow we made it to him after all sorts of bizarre misadventures. And something happened where, in order to save my life, I had to make a pact with the witch. And Rob tried to kill the Emperor. And then I tried to kill my friend Rob's character. Like, PvP. I'm going to assassinate Rob. And then something happened. And I don't know what... We were, like, brought out into a out-of-body experience. And then, like... brought up, and it felt like we were in outer space, but like our characters wouldn't know what that was, but like we were like in space looking down on like a space station, and there were these like biblical angels, except they were cyborg angels or something, and they were like, you're doomed, and they started making us descend toward fire, and we were basically doomed to like burn in space hell, but we begged, like, give us a chance. And they did, and then they put us back at the beginning of the adventure, right before we were contemplating going into the garden where we were first framed.
Wow.
And then we didn't, and like we went on and just went about our lives as normal guildsmen of the Torturers Guild, but tortured by these bizarre, otherworldly sci-fi secrets for the rest of our lives.
I imagine that's what it's like for characters when the players start talking meta. Where it's like they just have this like weird out-of-body experience to see these biblical cyborg angels talking about them as if they didn't exist, but they really did exist. Yeah, I imagine that's what it's like. I think that's something that I always want, regardless of like how serious or jokey a character is to have a nice ending, a conclusion to the story, whether it's like dramatic or mundane, simple or like a ongoing, you know, 2-year thing, or just a half hour with your friends. I think having an ending to a character is one of the most satisfying experiences you can have in an RPG.
Yeah. Well, was Kaber your second character?
I think so. He was either second or third. I think he was my third because I was in other groups in Roll20 before I found this Discord, and I made a old man swordmaster guy, and that group...
That sounds cool, actually.
Yeah, he was an idea... Actually, so, like, in my setting, you would know the Aloro family, right? So it would be Paolo Aloro's uncle was who this character was. This old war veteran who basically was rich and had everything they could want in life, but then they decided that... they didn't want to settle anymore. They wanted to go back out on the battlefield, but there was no war at the time. Like, there were no wars to be had, so he decided to go out and become an adventurer. But that game was a little odd, though. There's the chemistry was weird with those players, and playing with strangers, it was a new experience, and I don't think I was a very good player in that game, so that didn't work out. But that's okay, because then I found this group, and we have a good time here.
Yeah, and I mean, but that character, what a complicated and a storied experience. I mean, like, how many years? Was it 2.5 years from the beginning to end, perhaps, that you played that character? So, level 1 to level 20.
Oh, yeah, with Kaber? Yeah, that was a good time. The thing is, like, that was supposed to be the joke character. Like, I took a lot of time with the sword master character. I took a lot of time, like, developing, like, everything that they do and, like, their mannerisms and everything. And then you're like, hey, I'm going to start this game. Do you have a character ready? And I was like, not really. I was like, what if I just played a squirrel that became a person? Like, that sounds like a fun idea. And then that was, like, the whole thing. And then that character ended up being the one that I had to play for 2.5 years.
Yeah. Yeah, and in that play style, then you have me for, like, years of your life being like, so I need to really understand the squirrel's motivation better. Like, I really need to... Is it possible that he's actually... because, like, part of it was he was body swapped, so to speak. Like, he was supposed to be a noble, and then they took the actual squirrel and made the actual squirrel the noble, and they made the noble the squirrel, and so then when you became the noble, you fled. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's a pretty cool story, by the way. But anyways, then I was just like, how does he feel about being that? And you're like, I don't know, man. I'm a squirrel. I don't.
Right. It became something.
It
was
else,
such so. A it was such a silly joke, but then it became such. It had such depth to it. You start thinking about it when you're given choice and you're given agency and you're given, you know, riches and wealth and stuff. That's all good and well, but what happens when you can actually experience things like art and love and things that make humans? And that became a bit of grounding and a bit of depth to it. Like, at first it's a joke character of like, he's just a squirrel that wants to survive. But then you put him, give a squirrel the chance that a human has, and the sentience a human has, and they make human choices, and then it's a much more, it has much more gravitas to it. But,
yeah, and that was like his whole motif that kind of wove its way back and forth, were these things which happen in Dungeons and Dragons mechanically, where you can essentially lose the power to choose, and, he did that to other people. That was threatened to him. He began to uncover this history where it was done to people in this place a long time ago, and how and then by the end that was also the primary thing is like I just want to choose, you know. And yeah, I don't know if he ever did choose or not, though. I don't know if it, oh, yeah. You know, that's a question that as an observer, that for me remained a question. Like, I was like, I don't know, you know, like, was he a plaything of the gods, or did he actually ever choose? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a fun thing. It's like, is it fated, or was it willed beforehand? Yeah. That's something that I think there's a lot to be said about whenever you have a character idea before the game even starts, and you have an image of what you want. An image of, like, expectations of how the character is going to behave and what they're capable of before the game starts. And that leads me to my next question of which comes first, the character or the game?
The game.
The game. Yeah, that's pretty
well, simple. Actually, let me take that question and can I take that and kind of, like, play with the question a little bit?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. If I rephrase that question and I say, what comes first, the game or my character, it's the game.
Right.
Because the game implies the whole group and everyone's characters. But if you mean what comes first, characters, plural, or the game wherein the characters play, that entirely depends on the group and the game. Entirely. Yeah. And there are meaningful stories, which Jim Parkin, I discovered this word, picaresque. And that can make meaningful stories. You can have a relationship with a character where you're much more distant from them. And the stories can feel very meaningful. And I have had those. In fact, I would say even sometimes they're the most meaningful characters I've experienced that I play are those where I was more distant, and it was sort of me looking down into a terrarium and watching what happened to them. Mm. Or you can have characters that you're deeply invested in, and you put a bit of yourself in it. And I don't mean like you pretend to be yourself in the fictional world. I mean you take a bit of your soul and you put it in it creatively in a character. And people do both of those things. But I think sometimes people that are used to games where you put all sorts of creative effort into creating a character, I think there's a ton of misconceptions about that and how that works. A lot of people think that you need to do that on the front end. And I think that's unwise to just put it all on the front end. The meme is true, in my experience, that if you show up with a novella, it's sort of like when we were talking about preparation, and you're like, you have this big plan for the world, and then hardly any of it gets used, or something unexpected happens, and it can feel bad, not just that you wasted that creative energy, but maybe then that vision you had that you enjoyed was lost in some way. And characters will work the same way. You bring them to a tabletop role-playing game, they're going to go in a direction maybe you didn't expect. And they're going to emerge out of that soup, that maelstrom of creative play between lots of different people. And then what comes out of that is often much more interesting. So I would say, I think I'll take the risk of saying objectively, it is not a good idea to write a big story for your character and then present it. It is okay to have a really strong concept of a character, make it flexible, and then present it and say, all right, how can we work with this? How would this go? And then be a little open-minded and be ready for that to change. But you know, I love the old school Renaissance, and there are misconceptions there. First of all, that in the old school Renaissance, you can't have characters that you invest in, and that's been not true at all in my experience. We had a 14-month long old school essentials campaign, and we had moments where we were almost about to cry. Like we were deeply invested in those characters, and they were very meaningful to us. I just finished a 10-month long Dungeon Crawl Classics campaign. And we were big heroes of like we literally saved the world, and it was a big investment in the story, and it was immensely satisfying by the end. So the misconception is that, you know, an old school Renaissance game, well, you should just, you know, not care that much. Well, that's not true necessarily. The other thing is that. I forgot what I was going to say. Something about, let's see here. Which comes first, the character of the game? Oh, there is a, they, some parts of the old school Renaissance will sort of take that a little too far, and they'll say, it's just the game, the characters don't matter at all. And that doesn't need to be true either. That's not necessarily true.
Right. So. I think in modern games, people have the tendency to get custom artwork done, create these like Baroque custom journals where they're going to keep all their character notes. They have like these mood boards of different outfits that their character might wear. They have like all this whole thing. Like they get not just invested about the character itself, but like everything about the character, like what their preference is when it comes to food, you know, all this like really in-depth character, like I don't know what you call it, like acting, play acting, but like the game hasn't even started yet. And that's like the inverse of the characters don't matter. So could you give me an example of what you would think a healthy level of character investment is to present to your DM, like at session zero, like what's a good pitch for a character that's invested but not too invested, and like you said, is able to be flexible.
Well, let me skip ahead and actually say I think it's all fine. And right. everything that you just said, I think, is perfectly fine. Not only is it fine in a modern, what we call a original character or neo-traditional style of play, what people sometimes do with the modern game or games like it, but even in an old-school game. And in almost every example, except maybe the last one you gave, I actively do that right now with old school games and old school characters as a player. So for example, I won't get them, but I have notebooks that I keep, and in the notebooks I make little doodles,
right?
You know, I draw things. So one of the things that comes to mind is my friend Dave's Advanced Labyrinth Lord game, and we were adventuring in Barrow Maze. And Dave is very good at giving a really flavorful but succinct description. And the marshes outside of, I can't remember the name of the town off the top of my head right now, but you leave the town and you enter these marshes where there are cairns above ground. And you're going to crack into these cairns and try to get the treasure out of them. And of course, there are things in those cairns. But as we traveled through the marshes, I still remember him describing an obelisk rising from the mist, a black obelisk, and on it, the symbol of the god of death, Nurgle. And for me, it was a very spooky, mythical moment. And so I drew a black obelisk in my journal, you know, which is to say I'm not just invested in the character, but in the group and in the world and the game experience as a whole. So I did that. One of the things you mentioned was getting commissioned artwork. I have only done that for a character once ever, and it was for my friend who passed away. And that was in a super old school game, Swords and Wizardry, which is a retro clone of original D&D. And we play it in a classical playstyle where they have 10-foot poles and we measure the distances they travel and they have to keep track of their rations and they have all this kind of estate gameplay. And nonetheless, even in that very classical gameplay style, something very heroic and meaningful arose from it. It was very meaningful to all of us. And when he passed away, it was one session before they had built an army of mercenaries to march on a conclave of chaos warriors who had terrorized their people, and they were just about to bring justice, and he passed away just before that session. And so we, the player, the person, not the character, and so we, you know, set aside a little bit of our typical simulationism for that game, which we're very dedicated to, and he was given kind of a swan song, but in the context of choices that would still matter for the rest of the characters, and had a heroic death. And I paid for commissioned art of that character. What were the other examples you gave? Because I know I've done all of them. You said like journals.
Like a mood board. Like you just collect a bunch of images of things that you think are similar.
Yeah, okay, so I haven't done that, to be honest. But you know, I guess what I'm saying is, I think sometimes, especially people on the internet, can be a little bit too, it's like all or nothing, you know?
Yeah.
And another thing that comes to mind, there's another podcast I really enjoy. I think it's called Save or Die podcast. Mm-hmm. And there's a woman on it, and they talk about like super old school games, and they play like Holmes Basic and BX and things like that. And she played back in the early 80s. As a young girl, and she talked about what she did with her character, and they didn't understand the rules super well, but you better believe she drew pictures of her character.
Yeah.
And stories, and like there was all sorts of what you call play away from the table. And as a 12-year-old girl, you better believe she invested all sorts of creative energy and thought and desires that she had for this character, that she poured it out into notebooks and art and imagination and everything. So I suppose that's one barrier I'll kind of tear down a little bit, is you can care about your characters in an old school game, and you can work with the group in a new school game.
Yeah.
you can talk to the DM, and you don't have to... I suppose that is something I always consider invalid, and it doesn't matter what it looks like. If you come to a group and you're like, this is how it is, that's always invalid. Like, you always have to work together with the group, whatever that looks like.
Yeah, so you have an idea for a rogue. How invested can you get into that rogue before you have that first game? You know, is it okay to go all out before the first session? I guess is my question. Like what is a healthy level? You said you shouldn't come with a novella, you know, prepared. But like, I think that's a trope that all of us fall into, is getting invested. I think that just goes to show how much there is to enjoy about the hobby of RPGs, is the investment and the catharsis that comes out of the stories that we tell at the table. But if the session hasn't even started yet, you know, the game one hasn't started yet, I think that there could be a problem in the misaligning of expectations, especially something that I've felt personally. I have this cool character that I've thought about nonstop, you know, the last 2 weeks, and then the session finally comes up, and then the character, you know, dies after I made the superheroic knight, you know, and the superheroic knight character dies in the first encounter, and didn't expect that to happen. But you know, that if I would have paid more attention in session zero, maybe I would have understood the type of game that this was, right? So how invested can you get before the first session?
As much as still is consensual with the group. So, and that's something I think I'd love to talk about later, is I love talking about like play styles, and I think one of the things I actually love is all the chaos in the hobby. I like that there are different ways to play it, and sometimes even though I like one or two or three of them, I like to dabble in something that's different than what I would usually do. So I don't consider one playstyle. I don't have like a an orthodoxy of play. I don't. That's something right. I suppose I oppose. However, one style of play that I consider universally invalid is what I call non-consensual play, and that isn't just like sexual or emotional, which is what usually people talk about,
or violent, it's also graphic,
yeah, it's also social. So, and I describe this as like, if you're going to a you know, a party and everybody's a vegetarian, you don't bring a pepperoni pizza,
right? If the host has made a meal, you don't provide a bunch of spices to offer them to as the dish.
People make mistakes, that's okay, but the example of this that's often given with a character backstory is not just that you made a 5-page backstory, but then you didn't actually talk to anyone, came with the group, and then acted on that disappointment. So to me, that would be something non-consensual, or to put it differently, hey, we never even talked about this. Right. No one agreed to this. No one consented to this. I think to me, all of the locus of what is true and authoritative arises from the group dynamic, whatever the table says, whatever the group is doing. At the point at which that no longer works, it is appropriate for that person to leave that group, hopefully on good terms. And that can be a good thing, by the way. Like, it can be, hey, this isn't working for me, and that can be very healthy. But if the whole group is like, hey, we are specifically going to make really in-depth characters, and let's do it for like the next 6 months, we're not going to get to play together, and you're going to play the One Ring second edition by Free League, and the lore master is like, hey, go wild, in the book, anything in the book, make it. And make a character seeped in the lore of this place. And you provide those touchstones. And you're like, we're not even going to meet or talk. We're not going to get together because our friend is going on a trip. Or maybe you have somebody in the military and they're going to be deployed for 6 months. And they're going to come back. And that's something that, you know, binds you together. And every once in a while you get to talk about these things that you're looking forward to 6 months later. Yeah, that is totally valid. It's invalid when it's non-consensual.
Right, yeah. So it's something that, you know, a lot of people take for granted is, like, the idea of, you know, just because you have an idea that you think it's great doesn't mean everyone's going to think that same idea is great. And, like, you could have a joke character that you're super excited about as a joke, but if the people at the table don't get the joke or they're not excited about the joke, that doesn't mean that you throw the idea away. You could find a different table who enjoys that same sense of humor and actually, you know, really enjoys that. And if you are that player that has never felt like your creative outlet has actually been accepted, I just want to offer, and this sounds like it's condescending, but it's not. I have thoroughly enjoyed solo play. As a player, there is something
very... I think people are really starting to discover this style of play. Like, people are really starting to discover it big time now.
There are games that are being developed now for solo, with solo play in mind, that are just so good. Iron Sworn is so good of a system. There's Starforge is a similar by the same author. Like I said the last episode, I love the GM emulator. There's this little indie game I found on itch.io called Cartographer. That's literally just about exploring and mapping. It's like a mapping game. But there are all these solo games out there designed to help the solo player that weren't there before. And if you feel like you have these ideas of characters or stories that aren't being presented at the RPG table, there are solo tables that can be enjoyable too. I just wanted to say that to the people who want to hear that. But, you know, like I said, yeah, if you have a character idea that's not being accepted, you can always find a different table that can accept it. And yeah, don't feel bad that you've been obsessed with your character and their hairstyle and how they hold it up in this, like, cute little way and how they walk a certain way. Like, if you're excited about your character, that's perfectly fine. That's perfectly normal. That's just a part of the hobby that you can flourish in that some people can't. Some people actually have a hard time picturing what their character looks like, you know, being creative and thinking, like, I never even thought about what color my character's hair is, you know?
You know what this makes me think of? I had a friend once when I was already starting to really get into D&D, and he hadn't played D&D in a while, and I kind of got the sense of why, and it was because no one wanted to play with him, to be honest. And, I mean, he was my friend, and I like him, you know, but... I remember him saying, you know, I would like to play D&D if I could only just get, if I could just find a dungeon master willing to let me play this kobold that is this kind of flying kobold that can do these different type of actions in combat. Now, this is not smearing power gamers. That's not the point. Because that's valid, too. If you just like, you know, I want to be a sniper or I want to feel powerful and being that, whatever it is, like... RPGs do that. You can do that stuff. But the problem with that was not that he had something that he liked. The problem wasn't the thing he liked. I think the problem is if you took that same situation in a social dynamic and you applied it to dating, like, and you said that about, like, man, just need to find a woman that will just, like, you know,
let me wear a bathing suit everywhere all the time.
Yeah. I just need to find a woman that, like, really, you know, she needs to keep the weight off and needs to do da-da-da-da-da-da. I mean, that's atrocious because you're not interested in that person. Like, the person should come first. And that's the thing with tabletop role-playing games that's very challenging. And when we talk about tabletop role-playing games... Yes, solo play is a valid play style. I often forget to mention that one, but that's, in my opinion, totally valid. But, you know, we're talking about kind of I suppose what you'd call a conventional setup where you have a game master, because there's games where you don't have a game master.
Right.
We're talking about a game where you have a game master and you have players and you have that call and response where a game master describes something and you act on it, you know, like Dungeons and Dragons, for example. But anyways, in that situation, one of the big challenges, maybe the big challenge of being a player, is jiving with everyone else and being cool and, you know, being a good part of the group, supporting others, listening to them, sharing the spotlight, tossing the ball around, listening to others, being the biggest fan of their characters. That is immensely challenging as a player, and those are skills that, like, you even have to develop. So if you start with a character concept and you're like, the group in the game is less important than that, and you demand, it creates some kind of emotional demand where you're either resentful or disappointed, you know, or something, or you blame them. And I have seen these things happen. That is non-consensual. No one consented to that. That's like showing up to any other group or any other thing. That'd be like going on a date and saying, well, show me, I don't want to be crude, but, you know, like, show me your waistline or something, because I don't want to be crude. That is unacceptable. You should care about the person first and that connection with that person. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy to think about. Like, people have these ideas and they don't see them as a... They don't see the situation as a consensual group dynamic. You know, they wouldn't
consensual group dynamic. That's a great way to put it.
They wouldn't see it. They wouldn't act that way or make these type of demands on a date or even at work or at a dentist.
You wouldn't go to the movie theater. Like, if you had like five friends and you were like, "Oh, we're going to go see the new Top Gun movie," and you're all there, and then you stroll up and you're like, "We're not going to see Top Gun. We're going to see the new Legos movie." Okay.
That's a better choice of movie anyway, but that doesn't justify your choices.
Yeah.
Something that I wanted to add to that is, like, my worst experience with this problem I've had was in a 5th edition game, there was a player who wanted to play a human barbarian, and all they wanted to do was bathe in the blood of their enemies. And I was like, okay, that's pretty metal, but we can still run with that. And the first session, I depicted them at a campsite, right? And they're resting after this long battle, right? And now they're being approached by rustling sounds they hear in the leaves nearby. The player says, okay, I stand up, and I'm going to go to my pail where I keep the blood of my enemies, and I'm going to pour it on my head. I'm like, okay, you do so. You're now coated in the blood of your enemies. And then they are approached by these fairy creatures who need them to locate this nearby shrine to help them cleanse it of evil. But the whole entire time, the player says, but I'm still coated in the blood of my enemies, right? It's just dripping off my face. I'm like, yes, yeah, it was just so important to them that the blood and the gore was just always present in the story, regardless of what else happened around the world or the other characters. It seemed so so disingenuous from being invested in the game as a whole. Like, I don't think the rest of us didn't even need to be there. Like, this person just should have wrote themselves a little fantasy novel about their bloody character, and it would have been fine.
Yeah. And I don't know if this has just always been a part of the hobby, but it is something I've seen where there is a sense of, I don't know what to call it, sometimes, and I've done this. I did this in your game. I did not, because your game was the first chance I had to play a lot and consistently for a long time. And so I discovered, like, a forever DM can be a really terrible player, and I had to, like, learn skills that I didn't have. And anyways, I have seen and have myself done this sense of maybe like an entitlement, like a sense of, or maybe like a sense of, like, well, I have this character and I have these rights, and you as the dungeon master need to, you need to you sort of serve the purpose of meeting certain requirements since I have a character. And that, again, to me, is non-consensual, like not necessarily. Like the group may not agree to that. Now they might, you know. Or that's something that, like you're describing, probably wasn't clear to this person. But here we are and we're saying, you know, that actually when we look back, that wasn't very cool because everybody else was trying to do something. Everybody else was part of a group adventure, something that everybody was trying to do. And this person was really just trying to do their own thing and right. something for themselves. And again, I absolutely have done that. I've had that happen where I have something about a character and it's just like it's like a child that has a toy and it's like, this is my toy. And it's not a, it's that is probably good to just entirely set aside. Like a good basis to approach a group on would be like any other social dynamic. And I don't know if we pick that up from video games, where people come from video games and like you get to do whatever you want there and you're in charge of it and it's on your, you know, or if this is just always how it's been, or if it's like a modern culture thing, a modern tabletop thing.
I think it's something that, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but like your depiction there of like video games, it's the player that is only interested in the skins and like the gameplay has no effect on them. They just have the really cool skins. And to every other player there, the skin does not matter. You know what I mean? I feel like sometimes characters end up just being the skins, and it's not as important.
Yeah, and if that's what the group wants, or what everybody's doing, then that is awesome. Like, if it's, you know, kind of a paper doll game. I mean,
All right, moving on. we've talked a lot about new players and stuff, but I want to talk about a little bit more about Ross and Ross's experiences. Have you ever had a time as a player where your character has died and it was a meaningful death?
No. Next question.
Next question. Yeah. I don't think I have either. I've had a couple deaths that kind of just happened. Been shot down in a Star Wars game. I was shot down in that, what was it?
Yeah, of all the ones I'm aware of, I don't know that you have either. Yeah, you've just been cut down and that's it.
Cut down, sliced down, yeah. And the ones in my games, if you've died, you've just been sliced down. So, I think having a meaningful death isn't easy. I don't think it's easy to pull off without it feeling staged. The DM does the cursed sinful act of fudging a die or something along those lines. Without a linear story, it's very hard, I think, to pull that off.
Goodness gracious, that's its own podcast. It's just death in RPGs. But it can, again, I guess what I'm starting to try to sell here is the sense of there is no orthodoxy. There is no, this is how you got to do it. And I hear so many people say that. Like, if you go on the internet, there are going to be so many voices that are like, this is how you do it. If it's death, this is the way you need to do death in RPGs. And if you don't do that, you're wrong. You're even a bad person if you don't do that. It's nuts. Because, like, every table is different. Every game is different. There are different play styles. Even within individual playstyles, sometimes I'll talk to people and we just don't get each other at all. Like they have different goals and stuff. And I actually think this is a good thing. But anyways, I said I've never had a meaningful character death. And I said no, kind of jokingly. What I would say instead is I've had character deaths that I have adored. That I've absolutely loved. And I can think of a bunch of them where I remember my character dying and it was the coolest thing ever and I loved it. I remember, so I had two characters die in this recent Dungeon Crawl Classics campaign. I was on my third character by the time we finished the campaign. I think two other players lost one character at different points, but I had lost two. Like, so I had the group tally of most deaths. And the second character I had, my first character just died like a chump. And he was basically Conan the Barbarian. And he always talked like this. And he and he was like, Crom, count the dead. And he was just like, and everybody loved the Conan dude. I think his name was like Hans. His name was Hans.
That's
and everybody loved this dude.
Yeah.
And he just died like a chump. Even worse, I feel bad for my friend. In Dungeon Crawl Classics, you have spell misfires, and he cast like Poison Cloud or something, and it killed my character, which is great. I love it. Like that, immediately you already get the sense that like this is a certain kind of game.
Right.
Because in other games, people would not be cool with that.
Yeah, that'd be table flipping kind of bad in some games.
Right. I know, right? But anyways, my second character, you have met. And I regret to inform you of a tragic end to a journey to a character you know well. Canicus. Who you know was like the dude, but also like kind of like religious or something. Mm-hmm. Like he was like this like Celtic, you know, hippie, one with nature kind of guy, and he was just like, yeah, absolutely. He was just so flighty and
kind
floaty.
Kind of
reminded
me of the Doctor from Doctor Who.
Yeah, he was just like, and he would just appear places. That was like his whole shtick, is he would just like, because that's how we justified it back when we had the multiverse concept with our games. Mm-hmm. Well, anyways, Canicus fell into a horrible dark sword and sorcery world, and he changed as a person. Forcibly, mechanically, through insanity mechanics. And he began to worship, in Dungeon Crawl Classics, what's called the Logos, which means something entirely different than what it does in our world. And the Logos in Dungeon Crawl Classics is like this, like, series of geometric shapes that are taking over the universe, and they're making everything formless because they can't stand disorder. So he was a lawful cleric, but he wanted, like, basically the universe to end. And he converted all these people, and everybody loved Canicus, too. And Canicus basically became my insane zealot cleric. And all the other characters liked this dude. He had performed all these miracles. He was always the one that, like, had the big heroic moment where he stood against this evil thing, you know, and smote it, you know, and used his magic, and everybody's like, whoa, you know. And anyways, it all came down to this point where the island we were on, the undead were like swarming up out of the ground. Like there were like millions of them all around us. Like we knew we were going to lose. And so we struck directly at the temple of the god of death. In this Dungeon Crawl Classics game. And we descended into the Temple of Death, and there I led all my acolytes, Canicus did, in a battle where the halfling rode what are those chimeras? The ones with the lion head and the scorpion tail?
That's just a chimera, yeah.
Yeah, he rode one. No, a manticore.
Oh, a manticore, yeah.
The halfling rode a manticore into battle, and Canicus was like at the head of like these zealots that were just like crazy, and Canicus came up against this like, you know, towering black skeleton with a dark blade, and cast this spell, which I can't remember what it was, but in Dungeon Crawl Classics the spells are very powerful, and it essentially sundered maybe the blade, because this blade had this dark effect maybe where it could raise more undead every time it struck somebody. But then, so maybe, I can't remember what it was something like that where he disabled the dark blade, but then the enemy just basically crushed his throat or something, and Canicus died after months of play. Epic. So I've had deaths that I'm like, this is a good death. And then I've had like, well, he died like a chump. And when he died like a chump deaths, sometimes it's just funny.
Right.
And entertaining, and sometimes it's like, man, I really like that character, and that kind of stings.
Yeah. I've been thinking about running a funnel, because I kind of want just a slapstick kind of like, oop, he died, next, and kind of thing.
Oop, he died.
like a Looney Tunes style, like, oop, he got squashed. Oop, he is now a wall silhouette of himself, like those type of situations. because those can be fun. Like, if you just all just sit back and having a good time, you know, beer and pretzel type of play, that's something that I've always kind of wanted to do. But, like, I want to run that as a dungeon master. I think that'd be a fun experience, but I haven't had the chance to do that yet. I think something that's, you mentioned, you know, what is the difference between, you said no to the question, so what's the difference between Canticus's end, an epic death, versus a meaningful death?
Well, it's kind of like you said, like, how do you prepare for that? And to me, I really have a problem with that. There are some, this is me personally, okay? This is my personal taste. So anyone who doesn't do what I'm about to say, or anyone who, like, disagrees with me, your table is right and I am wrong for everything I'm about to say. But this is my preference. Deaths in RPGs, to me, need to be meaningful, because for me, death is meaningful. They asked J.R.R. Tolkien, if I recall correctly, they asked him what was kind of the primary theme of Lord of the Rings once, and he said death. Death is what is brings meaning to this entire story. It brings meaning to the universe, to all of this. Both on a grand scale, like the fate and death of mankind, versus the fate and death of Boromir. And to me, it's tremendously meaningful. And if you have a game that is afraid of itself, so you know I don't like that about 5th edition. It's maybe the thing I dislike the most is, you know, you go to 0 hit points and then you get to roll like 3 times. And as long as you pass, you're just not going to die. Unless you go minus all the way your hit points in the negative, which usually is an absurd amount. And then even then, at any point, if somebody can pop off a healing word as a bonus action, bam, you're up. And so many times it was like this whack-a-mole thing, mm-hmm. where it meant nothing. It meant nothing if you went down. And never mind being hard, what it did was it made death incredibly random. Whereas in some old-school games where you know you're going to die, if you choose something, and to me it's very important that things be based in player agency and choice. If that happens, it's meaningful. But if somebody chooses something, like when the characters died in month 13 of 14 in the Old School Essentials game, one of the characters was being a hero, and he knew it. He knew the risk he was going to take. And when he died, he died. And it hurt, and it meant something. And then we had like half a session of a funeral for him, which people don't even talk about in the old school, but it was something, his character meant something to us. So anyways, that couldn't be planned, I guess is right. What I'm saying. That's something that just had to happen. It's not something. I have seen games that have something called a swan song, mm-hmm. where maybe you have like, all right, you're going to die anyway, but you can do some cool stuff before it happens. You know, so you could approach that in different ways, but I have found it impossible to have any kind of pre-planned, meaningful character death. That's just me, maybe.
That makes a lot of sense. All right, so we've talked about the past. We've talked about some memories. We've talked about some other stuff, but we're going to talk about the future a little bit. Talk about something that you would like to do in the future. What is a character that you would want to play in the future if you had the chance to try?
I want to play a Han Solo.
Just a rogue in space?
Yeah. You were going to do like a space western game like we were... Because we used to do those multiverse kind of things where you mm-hmm. could drop in and drop out. And we had like... 3 or 4 of them going at one time at one point, and one of them was the space western game Outlaw Void, and I made a character for that. The entire drive of that was to be a Han Solo type of character. It was like a Kinku gunslinger, but also with like skills and piloting. The entire point behind that was to try to be Han Solo, because you know what's interesting is usually never end up playing the types of characters I want. There's always something that happens. And like the least, the type of character I like playing the least is usually the face, or the charismatic character. And I feel like sometimes, like half the time I end up with, like, well, he's the face, so he's the one that's going to have to talk. And like, I don't know what that is, but that's always the case. I do like, you know, big dumb barbarians or like meaty, you know, I love little people. I love playing gnomes and halflings and little goofy guys. And but I love wizards, especially old school magic user, which I have played. But I've never played a game of Traveler or White Star or Gamma World or something where I got to be Han Solo. I've never gotten to play that character. What about you?
For me, I want to revisit the Dwarf Rogue. I want to play a Dwarf Rogue. The idea of being this like stocky, bulky fellow who is also somehow lithe and nimble, that to me is just really interesting. that's all it is. It's just a short, squat guy who's surprisingly light on his feet. That's all I want. Because whenever I was introduced to 5th edition, I wanted to play a scout, like, but I didn't really want to be ranged-based scout. I wanted to be, like, come up and stab a guy, but also, like, do other stuff and, like, be a scout. So there wasn't anything in 5th edition that's like it, because a ranger is all, like, ranged-based, but they also have magic stuff. I didn't really see my character having magic. So I was like, oh, I guess I'll go rogue. Rogue's pretty scout-like stuff. There's even a subclass called scout. It's like, I'll do that. But yeah, I never actually got to fully invest into that, and I always want to return to it. And in Shadow Dark, the downside to a rogue is you roll a d4 for hit dice, right? But then a dwarf is going to give you advantage on those hit dice rolls, so it kind of counters each other's out and plays each other's weaknesses there. So that's
what kind of random trivia. Perhaps you already know this, but the original game, 1974, original Dungeons & Dragons, there were only three classes. There was a fighter, magic user, and cleric. And then you could play an elf, which could alternate between sessions. So you could start a session as a fighter, and it'd be like the next session you could be a magic user. And then you could switch back and forth, between, you know. But anyways... And so there were halflings, elves, and dwarves, and humans. But, you know, you could play a demi-human, but they had all kinds of limitations. But there were no thieves. There were no thieves in Dungeons & Dragons. And the first thief was actually a dwarf, presumably a fighter. I can't remember. But the legend has it that before they did the, I think it was the Greyhawk supplement, introduced the thief, so maybe this was in Blackmoor. I can't remember. I actually listened to an interview from the guy who literally played the first D&D thief ever. And what it was someone who was like, can I try to... Because you had stuck doors as a mechanic, and he was... And you'd have things locked and stuff like that. And he was like, well, can I take my dagger and try to pick the lock? And in that game, the referee, there was no rules for that. There were no ability checks. There wasn't some kind of like, oh, roll a d20 and blah, 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 or whatever. But then the referee was like, yeah, I guess. I mean, you know, because it makes sense, you know. And that's how we have the thief. So it was a dwarven thief. It was the first one ever.
Nice. So which do you prefer, a dwarf as the ancestry or the dwarf as the class?
It depends. Sorry for the noncommittal answer. It really depends. So there's like two approaches to this, and actually they map well. They don't map well with the modern game. So after the year 2000, and really maybe before that, even in 2E and etc. it didn't actually make sense anymore. And you had what I call humans with rubber masks. So it was like Star Trek, where you have like lots of people, and the people are all unique and different, or look different, or maybe are different sizes, but really they're just people.
Right.
Okay. So like that's a completely different approach. And so usually when they talk about it nowadays, that's the reason, you know, in the new game in 6th edition, well, actually, I think they recently changed this even for 5th edition, where you can just like make your racial, your ancestry attribute, whatever you want. You can just move it around however you want it.
Right.
And that makes sense when you have a society of fantasy peoples who they're just kind of like people in rubber masks. So setting that aside, I've really discovered kind of two strands of DNA in D&D, and they map to this race as class versus race as race kind of concept.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the original game, there was not race as class. That's a misconception. People talk about that came about in Moldvay Basic Set 1981 D&D. And the purpose of it was to keep things very simple. That was actually the purpose. However, it had an interesting side effect. And of course, that product line continued on up until 1991. The Rule Cyclopedia or whatever continued on for a long time. The interesting thing about having a race as a class is it makes them more alien, which has some really interesting benefits, and to me ties to the source literature. And when I think about the source literature, I don't just think Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings kind of suffers a little bit in its novels, where the dwarf and the elf, they're not that alien. I mean, they act differently than humans, but they're people. You know, and they're at least maybe it's kind of like marred by the movie adaptation where they're absolutely people.
Right. But they kind of have to be.
Another thing in D&D I think of is like Poul Anderson's Three Hearts and Three Lions, which the dwarf character who accompanies the hero in Three Hearts and Three Lions, there's this entire thing that I point out to people. Their ontology is different. Now, that's true in Tolkien, too. In Tolkien, the fate of elves is different than the fate of men. And the fate of elves is fixed, and they know that they'll go into the Undying Lands and eventually answer to the Valar and, you know, for eternity. But the fate of men is unknown. It's called the Doom of Men. And this is something very important. It's this sort of ancient fantasy, Western European Christian ideal of like, what's going to happen? You know, like once you die, what's going to happen? And anyways, the dwarf in Three Hearts and Three Lions was not burned by holy symbols. But he also could not be fully in the human world. So the dwarf in Three Hearts and Three Lions was sort of like a human. But once you went into the other world, once you went into Elfland, the elves were not. They were alien. They might as well have been aliens. Right. And they were burned. If you used a holy symbol or used the name of Christ, like the character in Three Hearts and Three Lions, the elves would be burned by it. And if you go back further than that to Lord Dunsay's King of Elfland's Daughter, then you start to see this kind of mythical fairy basis for how these things work, that these are the things of children's dreams. These are the things that lay beneath our bed. These are the things beyond the woodline within the dark pond that our parents told us to not go alone. And they're never certain, they're never clear, and we don't know what they are. And King of Elfland's Daughter, the elves have an entirely different ontological basis, and it's weird and uncomfortable and funny, because there's this question: well, can she receive the salvation of the friar? Because you know the daughter of the King of Elfland is brought and captive by the humans, And she never can quite, you know, like she can never be a human. And eventually she has to return to Elfland. And the creatures are ontologically different. They're sort of people, maybe, but however much they are, they're not anything that we can relate to. And anyways, if you use race as class, you have the opportunity to empathize with something completely different than you. And I noticed this about characters you enjoy, because you usually like to play characters that are very, very, very alien, like robots and literal alien critters. Mm-hmm. And like just literal critters, because you want to like connect with something truly other and see if you can empathize, see if you can put yourself outside yourself. And so race as class offers that opportunity to see demi-humans as something truly alien and then connect with something different. The other strand of DNA in D&D is the original D&D through AD&D.
That's there is a lot of letters. I'm sorry. The DNA through D&D and the DNA AD&D.
Like original D&D, 1974, really has a lot in common with first edition Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, they're the same game in a lot of ways. They just sort of developed over time. In that game, you start to encounter the interesting problems of having a demi-human that their race is separate from their class. Because then you start asking, well, these elves, they can see in the dark and they can detect secret doors and they're immune to being put to sleep and charmed. Why would I play a human?
Right.
And you know what's funny? Since 1974, the designers have never answered the question, why should I play a human? And to this day, no one plays a human. It's hilarious. Back in the day, they put all kinds of limits. Oh, well, if you're going to be an elf, you have to stop playing by the time you're fifth or sixth level or whatever it is, you know. And it'll be almost impossible to level. The progression chart for an elf in basic and expert D&D is, like, impossible. Poor Birdie played an elf in our OSE game, and she's like, when do I level? And I was like, yeah, you don't level. You're an elf. That was a long discourse on race and class versus just race as class. And
I think that's something that's interesting is the idea of, like, like you said, race as race, ancestry as just that, and versus it being your class and being everything about you and what you can do in the world. And something that I've always been toying with and in the back of my mind and chewing on is the idea of making my own heartbreaker that goes into stuff within my setting and dividing that and going with a classless system that goes into, like, your ancestry is what this bloodline, this ontology is where you get your abilities and how you act in the world and how the world sees you. But that, to me, makes it not D&D anymore, you know? And it's like, how do I say, hey, let's just play D&D, but let's use this supplement that I've made, and it's all specific to the setting and you know.
Well, I think that sounds really cool.
We'll find that line between, you know, when is, like, how much game design do I want to do, and how much do I just want to play this D&D with my friends? You know, because to me, this, you know, I think we both said this a lot, but the system doesn't matter. I think that's, we've said that a lot of times. It
matters how you use it, but it doesn't matter which one you pick with your friends. You'll have fun, but, like, you know, yeah.
But use as intended, like, to.
Yeah. I don't want to say system doesn't matter as in, like, take the system and then just, you know, ignore it, because you do end up actually experiencing problems. But if you're sitting around and you're like, what are we going to play? Hey, you'll have fun. Like, you know, maybe it's just more to say there's all kinds of stuff out there to enjoy. And in that way, the system doesn't matter very much if you're trying to figure out what to do.
Right. I've always found that really interesting is to get into the Mythic Isles and how dwarves exist, the ontology behind them, like what that is to me really unique. And I was saying, like, dwarves particularly are always the most fascinating to me, like the dwarves in the Vale, and the role that they played in the keeping the city safe, and how it's like this ancient technology that nobody knows anymore. What's her name? Gabby.
What did the dwarves do in the Mythic Isles? What makes them so? Obviously, we have Tolkien, right? So, like, the dwarves and Tolkien, they have a different fate. And on top of the, I think it was wasn't Manwë. It was the Valar of the Sea, the one that like loved making things. And so one of the Valar was like, I'm just going to go ahead and skip the line and make my own people.
Right.
Instead of, and they were actually potentially made ahead of the firstborn, because you have the firstborn, which are the elves, and then you have the secondborn, which are the humans. And so they made the dwarves in secret, and I think it might have been Manwë who was like answer for this, and the dwarves simply begged for their existence. And what a weird creation story. What a quirky, you know. Anyways, what is it in the Mythic Isles? What's the deal?
So clearly, I've been inspired by Tolkien. In the Mythic Isles, is set place in this world known as Orokin, and there are no Valar or elder beings per se, but there are these beings called the Beings of Rain and Mist, and when they came to be. They kind of took the world as it was and kind of shaped it to what they wanted it to be, and thus it has gained the name Orokin, which means the ever-changing land, right? It's like this land that's constantly in flux. And in part of that fluctuation, part of the Earth's core was revealed, and this like core, also known as like the Heart Rock, was taken. And from it, the first dwarf was chiseled, and like these creatures are like made of stone originally, and then like over time they were refined, like a bloodline that is going after some type of genetic feature, they were hewn and rather forged into beings of not stone but iron, and they're said to like have these bones of iron. And these unbreakable bones,
cool.
and these creatures became known as the Iron Folk. These creatures that are incredibly durable.
I love that.
And like a feature that I've always thought them to have is a feature actually from older games of D&D, where they always know their sense of depth.
I love that.
To me, I think the Iron Folk have like this organ in their nasal cavity. That can smell minerals and know what deposits they're nearby and like how deep they are, and, like
that's awesome.
Like to me, the ecology and goes with the ontology and like all these like studies of what this thing is and how it acts is fun. But then when a player comes up and they just want to be Gimli, I'm not gonna be like force feeding my ontology or like what these dwarves mean to it down the throat. However, because they chose to be a dwarf in my game, that means the world is going to see them as that, whether they, you know, like that or not. And I actually encourage them to disagree with it, like to challenge the world's view of what this thing is and how it needs to be seen. Because to me, that is interesting. Because to have the world tell you something that you are not, I feel like that takes courage to attest to that and say, I am not this thing that you label me to be. And that to me has much, that's deep. Like that's real deep. And like that to me is like the core of why I think picking your race is important in my game.
Cool.
But I would like to hear more about the Vale and like what role the dwarves have in the Vale. Cause I know this Vale, from what I understand, is like this nexus point between different realities and stuff. So how did the dwarves come to play a role in that?
The Vale is my second homebrew setting in D&D that I have made. And the purpose of it was intended to mechanize or gamify the truth of what was happening at the table. which, and in so doing, that would facilitate play. Now, that sounds kind of abstract, but what was going on was COVID was going on, and I was meeting people that were strangers on the internet, and we were playing for the first time D&D across a screen online with a virtual tabletop. So all of us were kind of stepping into the wardrobe or falling through the looking glass into something none of us were prepared for, and none of us like knew how to navigate it. And so I was like, this is just what's going to happen to your fictional character. And the veil represents just a fictional dream state of what people experience in trying to connect during those uncertain times in the hopes of having a place where they could work out everything that was going on and find some hope that something could have a direction. So at the time, the veil was sort of like Lord of the Rings, where the gods were involved and they had a plan, and there was this great evil force and antagonist, and it was up to the heroes to just do their part in order to bring down this antagonist. Maybe that all sounds like bog standard D&D, but the reason that matters is the veil is a demiplane, and every hero falls from outside of it into it, from the outside. So maybe they're from the Forgotten Realms, or maybe they're from somebody else's homebrew world, or from Earth, doesn't matter. And then something liminal happens in their life, and they fall through a liminal space and end up in this demiplane. And that was meant to actually account for everything that was going on. So, for one thing, none of us had met before, and I was meeting new people all the time, and they were all just falling into this world. And they were all adventurers, and they were all going on adventures. And there was a need to figure everything out. There was a drive for everything. And the veil is what I call a kitchen sink fantasy, which is to say you had like tieflings and you had things from everywhere. You had bird people and turtle people, right, and, you know, like a whole mishmash of things that don't really necessarily make sense together, except if all of a sudden they are mashed together. So like the veil physically accounts for why all this is happening and why it matters and what to do about it. That's what the veil is. So, dwarves. The dwarves are from the Forgotten Realms. And much of the stuff, which, if people don't know, that's like kind of like the modern D&D default setting, if you will. And in the modern Forgotten Realms, dwarves are hardy, and they are tough, and they know a lot about stonework and metalwork, and they keep grudges for centuries. And they live a pretty good long while, and they're very, very tough. And that's sort of all dwarves are, except in the Vale, something happened in the history. So there's also these cycles of history. History goes back about 3,000 years, as far as anyone knows, and there was this sort of arrival event from outsiders into this wild space that was this demiplane in the past. And then there were these cycles of history, and there's this really terrible thing that was brought to this place by those outsiders. And it always afflicts every single cycle. And it's this magic that contorts and changes things from what they are. And then it corrupts, and things can never go back. They can never go back to the way they were. And anyways, this happened to the dwarves. And they never figured this out during the Evening Lands campaign. It was a big theme, actually. And it may come up because I actually have a whole mega dungeon about this that's prepped for the Veil, if anybody ever goes into it. But basically, the dwarves made a kind of Faustian bargain to have this powerful magic, and it corrupted them, and it ended the kingdom of Kel'Ra'az. It ended their kingdom, the kingdom of the Silver Potentate. And as a result, there are very few dwarves left. And those dwarves that are left no longer remember the magic they had. But there are these great dwarven works that scattered around the world. Sometimes they're filled with horrors and treasure because of the terrible things the dwarves did. And as far as Galby Mudbelt, she passed on from sadness into nothing, because the adventurers failed. They failed to reunite her with her people. And the magic that defended the walls was a corrupt magic. Well, she was the last dwarf that knew how to do it from her father. And when she died, now, you know, at this point in the Vale, no one knows how to make those magic works anymore. But yeah, and the dwarves have they can stone sing, which is sort of referenced in like Lord of the Rings, right, where you can actually literally talk to stone and talk to mineral, and you can converse with it and sing it with it, and it can kind of mold in magical ways and do things it otherwise couldn't do.
That's super cool. I'm stealing that. That makes too much sense.
Stone singing.
Yeah. But yeah, I always found that super interesting. That was probably one of my most, like, that was the most interesting thing to me, was trying, like, as Caber, was trying to figure out how the heck do we build these walls that sustained for so long, and, like, how does this happen? And that was something that he failed to figure out, and it seems like others have failed to do so later in the game. And that, to me, is, like, super interesting, too, because I didn't know until just now that the magic itself was corrupt too. Like it was not a pure thing. Like I thought like building the wall was a pure virtuous task to do, but little did I know that would be in vain anyway, because it's striving for something that would be corrupt.
I think two major, kind of talking about ontology and theology, like how do the gods work? How does good and evil work? I love that worlds can do this differently. Like, and I love how the Mythic Isles has this emphasis on karma, mm-hmm. and this direct, you poke something and it pokes back. And you can sense that about the world, that there's this rubber band tension of how the gods and how the forces of the world interact. And I don't think that's true, for example, in the Vale. But anyways, two major influences for me are the Tao Te Ching and, of course, the Bible. And so you take these two kind of things, and to quote the Tao Te Ching, maybe paraphrase it, what is a good man but a bad man's teacher? What is a bad man but a good man's job? And the Tao Te Ching claims that this is the secret of life. That is to say, there is good and bad, but when someone is corrupted, it doesn't make it who they are. And the purpose of good is to actually make something bad good. It heals. And so I think, for example, in the Vale, you can have a corrupt magic, and that was sort of the thing, is everything is corrupted by this, like
right.
all over the world. And it's a muck that everybody's in, and it constantly threatens to pull them back into that. But that which is good is also active, and it is so regardless of that pervasive evil. So that's why you end up with this evil magic that then a good dwarf uses to make good walls for good people.
Yeah, that's good to have that. You can have the that comes full circle there. That's awesome.
I might say complicated people actually. I don't. They're, it's complicated.
Well, yeah, because
should probably.
yeah. Last thing I have for you is what is a misconception that you have about dwarves particularly?
It's not that they're Scottish, because Scottish dwarves are cool. They are cool. That's not it. However, because dwarves are Scottish, like in like lots of modern fantasy, then they take on all of the attributes of being Scottish, and then you can miss out on all these little weird things that might not be Scottish. So the primary cultural influence for Tolkien was Hebraic people, like Jewish people. And that is so interesting and fascinating, and there's so much. Like, for example, the actual language Kazdul is similar to Hebrew and in a lot of ways. And Kazdul itself is like this really fascinating, what we know of it is just a fascinating language. Anyways, you stand to lose that that the possibility of having something like that, if it's like, nope, they're all Scottish. So like in World of Warcraft right now, if you go to the Dwarven starting zone in Cataclysm or before, like the dwarf places, and you go in that area, you'll see like Lochdermot or whatever it is, like, and that's lake, right? Loch is a, mm-hmm. a lake, and you know, then it's just Scottish, and you don't get to have other stuff. And one of the things I love to have on my dwarves is their skin is the color of stone,
right?
And their veins look like the fracture lines of stone is or like the veins within a rock or an mm-hmm. ore. And I think that's more interesting than just like having, you know, pasty folks with like ruddy, you know, kind of Santa Claus type features.
Right.
Because they all have the big nose and they all have the big rosy cheeks and, you know, and. I do like beards, you know, that's, I mean, obviously I like beards, but.
Yeah, I think a misconception that I've heard about dwarves is how they're natural sprinters.
Clearly not true.
Yeah, clearly not. I don't know, the guy on the bounty board over there, he looks like he's pretty quick.
Don't look over there.
Everyone here knows I've been eyeballing that bounty. I'm just gonna go get it real quick. Hang on. Yeah, see this right here? Yeah, we gotta catch this guy. That's a good reward right there. 100 gold. That's a good reward.
I think I'm gonna take a couple of days off. I'm gonna do some estate gameplay. I'm gonna do some. I have some downtime activities that I need to
get downtime. To. Okay. All right. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Hey, you do that. You go downtime.
All right. Well, thanks again for hanging out with me, Jake.
Yeah. Thanks for having me here at the Cozy Crow.
Mythic Mountains RPG is a private online play club that focuses on folk RPGs. Folk RPGs are the games that belong to all of us. They're what actually happens at a table between friends. It's their voice that has the authority on what is fun and what works for them. Weekly, we upload our games to allow others to sit in with us. The channel isn't monetized. We don't own the artwork, music, software, or games shown in these actual plays, and you can find links to their authors in the description. Like, subscribe, and share if you wish, or don't. Just like games in person, you're welcome to pull up a chair, sit in, and watch some of our games. No performances, no fancy equipment, just regular people playing folk pencil and paper role-playing games and having a good time. We hope these games will prove a source of enjoyment to anyone just wanting to listen in, anyone looking for examples of how actual groups run and play folk RPGs, and most importantly, if you haven't found your group yet, you're welcome here. Thank you.